This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Last week, President Obama laid out his strategy for a new phase in the so-called war on terror. He repeated his belief that Guantanamo Bay Detention Center should be closed, and he cited political reasons for his failure to do so until now. He also outlined a new policy that scales back the use of drones to kill suspected national security threats. Our weekly news roundtable takes up these issues today. Scott Silliman's an appellate judge at the United States Court of Military Commission Review. He reviews cases tried at Guantanamo Bay, and he's a professor at Duke Law School. David Chancer's with us as well, a professor at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy and director of the Triangle Center of Terrorism and Homeland Security. We also have Ariana Vigil, who is a professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
So, Scott, President Obama promised to close Guantanamo in 2008. He hasn't done it, and there's no sign that he's going to do it any time soon. Why is this so difficult?
Frank, the problem is that Congress, for three consecutive years, has denied the president any funding to move the detainees from Guantanamo Bay. It's one thing to say, Mr. President, you can click the lights off. The real dilemma is, what do you do with those 166 detainees that are down there? There are three groups of detainees. There is a small number, perhaps 25 or 30, for which there is some evidence of criminality. They can be prosecuted in a military commission or, if Congress would rescind their statute, in a U.S. court. There are some who have already been cleared for release, but no country is willing to step up and take them. The most difficult group are those for which we can't prosecute for whatever reason, but they are deemed to be too dangerous to be turned loose. That's called the legacy group of detainees. And that's the group that's the most difficult to deal with. What do you do with them?
If you can't prosecute them, that suggests you have a problem with evidence, I guess, right? I mean, you don't have enough evidence. Well, then how do we know they're a threat?
Well, there may be evidence, Frank, that evidence may have been procured by torture or cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, so that either in a military commission or a trial in this country, you couldn't use that evidence. So you don't have enough evidence to even bring them to trial, but the evidence is there that showed that they were involved in some kind of a terrorist plot. So it's not just guessing that they are terrorists. You have a pretty good quantum of evidence that you just can't use, and that raises the dilemma. Do you just turn them loose?
David?
I mean, we might have information, but information and evidence are different things. Evidence is information that is actually admissible in a judicial proceeding of some sort. Information could be gleaned from hearsay evidence or maybe an intelligence source or method that we can't introduce into court.
Well, so, but we don't make it impossible for us to get at the truth by these rules of evidence. We say that there are varying degrees of credibility, and that's why certain evidence is inadmissible. So again, how certain are you? If you waterboard me, I will confess to every crime since the fall of Rome. And we know we can't accept that because I might have been lying just to save my life.
No, and I don't believe our intelligence community should be relying for their determinations of dangerousness on evidence procured by unlawful means. So, but we might have what we call intelligence from somebody said something to somebody, and we believe that to be true. Yet, it's not evidence that could be admissible in a court. And I think it's. And so we make our estimation of danger. And let me just also say, the issue of Guantanamo, we're talking about a wartime detention based on national security. We're not making a determination. The determination of dangerousness is based on what we think is in the national security interest. And it's lawful because it was based on a battlefield capture. This is not like arresting somebody and trying to put them in jail for a specific crime with a specific punishment.
Yeah, and to follow up on what David was saying, Frank, again, you may have information. It may be deemed by all the world's intelligence sources to be credible information, but you can't use that in a court of law because you'd be sacrificing and revealing the sources and methods that was used to get that intelligence information. So most of the intelligence is deemed to be fairly credible. It's just that you can't use it in a court of law, and yet these people would create a problem if you release them.
I'm quite sure the CIA itself has admitted, though, that evidence obtained through inhumane means, through torture, is not accurate evidence. So I guess I would second David's questioning of the veracity of that evidence. I also question the designation of too dangerous to release. Is that some kind of designation that holds up in other courts, because according to the Center for Constitutional Rights, that's essentially a made-up designation. It means nothing.
Does it have legal, any kind of legal standing, David, that designation?
Well, this is the debate. The human rights community believes very strongly that we don't have a right to detain anybody unless they have committed either a war crime or a domestic crime, and that therefore, if you can't try them, that they have to be released. But that's not what the Supreme Court said in a 2004 case. It said that if you're at a time of war and Congress has authorized us to use force against al-Qaeda, that there is the right to detain until the end of hostilities. And in some ways, that's what President Obama was beginning to get at, is that the hostilities are not the same now as they were at the time of 9/11. And we need to begin to adjust our policies and our thinking about these in light of that reality.
Yeah. And Congress just last December, in the very fiscal 2013 National Defense Authorization Act, reiterated that the authority to use force, which Congress gives the president, includes the authority to detain those that were involved in 9/11. That's the debate that's going on right now. Do you need an updated authorization from Congress? Or, as the president clearly signaled a week ago yesterday, he's moving away from reliance on an authorization for the use of military force. He wants to say we're no longer in a global war on terror where you can kill a member of the enemy wherever they are. They don't have to be an imminent threat. So he's clearly moving towards what we call national self-defense against a continuing and imminent threat to U.S. persons and the country. That's not new. It's what President Reagan used in against Libya in 1986. It's what President Clinton used as his justification against the strikes in Afghanistan. So I think what President Obama is doing is he's moving back towards a more precise international law definition of why we can use force and away from something that most people have criticized as a global war, which technically under the law could take place even in the United States.
President Obama was never comfortable with that terminology. Remember his interview with Anderson Cooper, which I think we showed in our class one time, where he specifically called it a war against al-Qaeda in the early part of his term, moving away from how President Bush had conceived.
And now even more directed and more limited to say not only a member of al-Qaeda, but one who is present, who is presenting an imminent threat.
A continuing and imminent threat.
But let me ask you about this, though. The problem is that they're on this thing called, they're on this little tip of Cuba called Guantanamo Bay that has this kind of nebulous legal status. And that's his problem. He can't get them off of that place. Once he got, why are they there? Remind us, Scott.
All right. He started, it goes back to President George Bush. And when we started getting detainees from the battlefield in Afghanistan, as David was talking about, he was looking for a place that would be law-free, which the U.S. courts would have no ability to intervene in. And there are only two places in the world like that, Guantanamo Bay and Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, but the Brits owned Diego Garcia. So he chose Guantanamo Bay because there was a 1950 Supreme Court decision that said that if you've never been in the United States and you're not a U.S. citizen and you're located and confined outside the United States, you have no constitutional right of habeas corpus, period. That was the legal theory that ultimately came unglued in 2008 when the United States Supreme Court finally ruled that those at Guantanamo Bay, nowhere else, at Guantanamo Bay, had the constitutional right of habeas corpus. So no detainees have been taken there since then.
I'd actually like to add a slightly larger historical framework to Guantanamo Bay. The reason we even have access to Guantanamo is due to legislation that was passed, written into Cuba's constitution at the turn of the 20th century in 1901, when the United States made it a threatened Cuba with military intervention if they did not grant access to the United States. One of the things that President Obama said that was interesting in his speech is he mentioned, he kind of said that the question about different kinds of technology and detention was not only a legal one, but also a moral one. And he mentioned something about using different kinds of strategies with a certain amount of constraint. And I think if there's one thing that the history of U.S. intervention really throughout the Western Hemisphere, but particularly in the Caribbean and particularly in Cuba, tells us is that the United States has historically failed to exercise any kind of constraint. And so I think we are having a better historical perspective offers us an understanding of what's going on right now.
Well, and it seems that the president is certainly aware of that, if not the deep history, and I'm sure he is, the impact that it's having globally. And maybe you can talk about that, David, and that is and the president talks about this. He's concerned about the impact this has on our reputation abroad and its effect on potential other terrorists.
I mean, I think this is what was very striking to me about the entire speech was here is a wartime president who understands the need to use force, lethal force, is willing to do so, but then also understands the negative impacts of different types of use of force, whether it's a drone strike or detaining individuals, which is something that kind of comes after you use force to capture them. And he understands that all of those things have ramifications, not just on vague notions of morality, but also on, which you know, are important, but also on our national security. And so when we are forced to keep detainees alive by force feeding them through their nose, and that's made known to the world, and it's proliferated through social media, and Al-Qaeda and various organizations and use that to try to show, oh, yes, doesn't this show that the United States hates Muslims and that we're willing to treat people as if they're not humans? That is a national security. It rises to the level of national security because it makes it harms maybe our troops and it helps recruit people to oppose us. So all of those things are critically important. And this president is grappling with those tensions.
On the state of things today, David Chancer, professor at Duke Sanford Public School of Public Policy, Ariane V. Hill, a professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and Duke Law School professor Scott Silliman. Just ahead, we will look at drones, the new policy governing the use of drones on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with our news roundtable about drones and about Guantanamo Bay and President Obama facing the challenge of revising U.S. foreign and national security policy. Scott Silliman is a professor at Duke Law School. He is also an appellate judge who oversees and reviews cases, legal cases at Guantanamo Bay. David Chancer is a professor at Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. Ariane V. Hill is a professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So we're talking about President Bush and the political problem he faces. He wanted to close Gitmo. George Bush said he wanted to close Gitmo. John McCain said they wanted to close. And Barack Obama said during his speech, his problem is Congress.
After all, under President Bush, some 530 detainees were transferred from Gitmo with Congress's support. When I ran for president the first time, John McCain supported closing Gitmo. This was a bipartisan issue. No person has ever escaped one of our supermax or military prisons here in the United States, ever. Our courts have convicted hundreds of people for terrorism or terrorism-related offenses, including some folks who are more dangerous than most Gitmo detainees. They're in our prisons. And given my administration's relentless pursuit of Al-Qaeda's leadership, there is no justification beyond politics for Congress to prevent us from closing a facility that should have never been opened.
So, David, why is this a problem?
I think it's a problem because it would be very difficult to withstand a 30-second attack ad in a campaign that said, my opponent voted to bring hardened Al-Qaeda terrorists to our shore. I don't think very many politicians are willing to take that on and confront it in the course of a campaign, and therefore they will not vote against these restrictions that President Obama is railing against in that speech.
And Ariana, you've suggested that the fact that these are Muslim terrorists makes it easier to produce that attack ad than it would be for, say, a Timothy McVeigh and the various anti-American, violent anti-government groups that he represented and was in some way tangentially part of.
Yeah, I think race is clearly a factor in terms of who and what we label a terrorist, what color of skin that that identity gets applied to. But if I may, one of the things that I thought was most interesting about that last clip was the analogy that Obama draws between the U.S. penal system and Guantanamo. And what he essentially says is that Guantanamo is superfluous in terms of the U.S. prison system, that it is not some kind of horrific outlier, that the same kinds of facilities that already exist on U.S. soil are replicated in Guantanamo. I think also the hunger strike, we know that just recently there were major hunger strikes in California from prisoners. So what I would like to point out is that actually Guantanamo is much more similar to the U.S. prison system than we may want to admit, and that if you think that closing Guantanamo is a good idea and that the kinds of practices that are happening at Guantanamo are horrific, you should also consider the kinds of practices that happen within prisons on U.S. soil and closing all of those as well.
Frank, your listeners may recall that in late 2009, President Obama actually proposed bringing the detainees from Guantanamo Bay into a prison that they were going to buy in Thompson, Illinois. And it was shortly after that that Congress then responded and said, we're not going to allow the president to have one dime of appropriated money to bring a detainee from Guantanamo Bay into the United States for any purpose, whether it be trial in the federal courts or just incarceration in one of our facilities. So, again, as David suggested, it is very political now. I am convinced that President Obama, if he could, would like to close Guantanamo Bay as quickly as he can. But it's the Congress that is prohibiting him from doing it, and that becomes a very political issue. And I think David and I would agree, we don't see the politics changing soon.
Well, talk about the point, though, how different is the process, the criminal justice process faced by Guantanamo Bay detainees than other detainees, and how different is that process from the American jurisprudence system?
When you're talking about military commissions at Guantanamo Bay, and there have been seven trials since 2006, and Congress actually statutorily created the system, it is 95% of the system that we use to prosecute our own servicemen and servicewomen, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Congress in 2009 refined the act. But for one exception for hearsay evidence, it's basically the same. The detainee is presumed to be innocent. There is a burden by the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Any statement made, even if it's not under coercion, must be shown to be voluntary. So this is the same system. It's virtually the same as you'd find in a federal district court. And that's what many people don't understand. They believe that some kind of classified evidence can be used to convict a detainee without his ever seeing it. That's not the way the statute reads. I believe the system, it's not perfect, but it's a lot fairer than most people understand.
And I agree with that, but let's just make one point clear. The president is also proposing to essentially use American prisons or facilities for what we would call wartime detention without trial. And that's something that really does not have a parallel in our domestic system. And if we transferred all those people to a facility somewhere in the United States, the Human Rights community would still protest and say that's an unlawful form of detention and say we've just closed Guantanamo South and created Guantanamo North. So in some ways, even closing the facility, if that's the way it was done, if wartime indefinite detention continued, the controversy would still continue.
What about the indefinite nature of this war? Is there anything in international jurisprudence, international legal codes, or our own that suggests that you can't do that? You can't have an indefinite period for which you would detain anyone.
Yeah, Frank, this goes back to that case that David mentioned where the United States Supreme Court, the Hamdi case, the Supreme Court said that you can detain someone picked up on the battlefield in Afghanistan as long as there are hostilities going on. That's the issue that's being debated now. As we close down our U.S. presence in Afghanistan, that legal predicate is going to go away for detention. That's why the issue is, should Congress reauthorize somehow a broader scope of detention? And I see the president saying, I really don't want to go there. I don't want to rely on the authorization for the use of military force or a new one. I want to move towards a national self-defense where we're not necessarily capturing folks to bring them to Guantanamo Bay or somewhere else. We are using force very selectively against a continuing and imminent threat.
What about the rules governing imprisonment itself, the conditions that prisoners face at Guantanamo? Any different than a federal prison?
I think that you're going to see the same type of conditions at Guantanamo Bay that you'd see at Fort Leavenworth for military prisoners or other supermax prisons. Again, some of the guards that are used at Guantanamo Bay rotate and then go back to their regular job at Fort Leavenworth. The International Committee of Red Cross has been down there visiting. There are periodic checks made. Now, I think we would all agree there's been significant improvement from 2002 until now. But the United States has a dilemma with regard to this force feeding of the hunger strikers. You can't let them die, and I think the president mentioned this in his speech. On the other hand, you're going to be criticized for keeping them alive by force feeding by saying that that's some kind of a torture. So I understand the dilemma there for the president.
So what? Go ahead, Ariana.
I would just encourage us. I agree very much with what you just said in terms of the kinds of similarities between domestic facilities and Guantanamo. And I would, again, just to bring this home, call our attention to just today, the warden of NC Central Prison here was promoted at just weeks after having evidence presented about inhumane treatment of prisoners. So this kind of treatment of prisoners that we are looking at Guantanamo, as horrific as it is, we would do well to look at it happening right here as well.
Well, David, that raises an interesting question. Is our adjustment to these new rules for an ongoing war that may never have an end, a constant threat of terrorism and our worry about national security, are they changing our views on domestic jurisprudence and how we treat people in this country and our sense of civil liberties in general as a public policy matter?
I think in some respects that we've done a pretty good job in 10-11 years of this conflict to essentially not to hold to our bedrock of our criminal justice system. Now, a lot of people argue we should use the criminal justice system more for terrorism, and I think there's a lot of merit to that. But we haven't, in some ways, I don't think, really eroded the core values of our criminal justice system and our commitment to constitutional rights in the post 9/11 period. What we've been struggling with over this past decade is that there are different paradigms for dealing with this. There's a war paradigm and a kind of a law crime paradigm, and some people really believe in the crime paradigm. Some people believe this is all about war. I believe Scott agrees with me here. It's really a mixture, and we pull from different strands of these past authorities to try to come up with the right answer that meets the nature of this conflict. And because the nature of the conflict is changing from one with an incredibly powerful centralized organization that was able to execute a tremendous attack on a United States soil to one that is much more diffuse, therefore kind of our legal authorities have to adjust to that as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with David on that. And I see what the president doing in his speech last week is moving from that far right view of we're constantly at war all over the globe. We can strike wherever we want to. Not going to a international human rights concept, which is pure law enforcement, but to this middle ground, which, again, we've used previously in the past, where we will respond to attack and disable threats wherever they are, but we'll do it precisely in accordance with a very refined criteria. And I think we're going to have to explore with this and see how it goes.
But we'll take preemptive action necessary.
Yeah, that's national self-defense that goes all the way back, interestingly, to 1837, which is where there was an incident in Upper Canada that created this concept of anticipatory self-defense. Yeah.
So you're taking a good critical look at the law and how we're trying to parse the law, how we see it professionally. But you said, Scott, something interesting, that most people perceive Guantanamo as a place where we can do these kind of extraordinary and extra-legal proceedings that will allow us to get at these guys. And that's not true. So I'll ask you and then I'll ask Ariana, the effect on the public imagination of all of this and whether or not we have the right to and should use extra legal means and expand our legal system, perhaps degrade our legal system in the name of national defense. Is something like that happening in the public imagination, not necessarily in the law?
I think the public is looking back to the early years and what the CIA was doing in its black sites and assuming that that's continuing on. When you take a hard look at it now, under the Obama administration, all that's been cleaned up. He closed the black sites. He has prohibited torture and cruel and human and degrading treatment. So I think what we need to do is look at Guantanamo Bay as it is right now. And as Arianna said, there is not that much difference between the facilities and what's being done at Guantanamo Bay than you would find in a prison in the United States.
Well, one thing you said earlier was the idea that now Obama is operating with a more refined policy. And I want to make two other points from his speech. One is there was actually he had made a slight difference in what he was speaking about last week, in which he talked about strikes against those who pose an imminent threat. But he left out an earlier clause in which he had talked about high level officials, I believe. So I would actually dispute the idea that he's even narrowing the scope of who he's going after, because he didn't indicate that with that kind of a mission. And the second thing is, I think, again, evidence of that. I don't understand how killing 16-year-olds is part of a refined policy.
Well, I'm not saying, I don't think anyone's saying he's going to kill 16-year-olds. But when I say it's more refined is, in the criteria, there's got to be a near certainty in the terms of the policy guidance that the individual's there, and a near certainty that there will be almost no civilian casualties to doing it. So he is not sticking only with senior members of al-Qaeda, but he's saying if there is a threat out there that is continuing an imminent threat, then the United States reserves the right under international law to take anticipatory self-defense action.
But we've seen failures of that policy.
Well, the other thing is that senior al-Qaeda now, and maybe you can correct this perception, but it seems to me that the senior al-Qaeda official is no longer a target unless they're actively engaged in an imminent threat. Whereas under the old policy, the very fact of their position within al-Qaeda made them a target. So it is an interesting distinction.
Again, we're moving from the status of being just a member of al-Qaeda now to that individual, whether it be high or low, has to constitute a continuing imminent threat against the United States. That's the criteria.
And also with the 16-year-old, I think you were referring to al-Awlaki's son, who was not a target of the attack but was an unfortunate victim of it. And I think that's an important difference. I don't think we're out there targeting 16-year-olds. But that gets to the issue of civilian casualties, which is, of course, in all wars, is an important thing to try to avoid. And it is an unfortunate circumstance that is totally unavoidable when you're using force.
Something the president addressed in his talk last week.
To do nothing in the face of terrorist networks would invite far more civilian casualties, not just in our cities at home and our facilities abroad, but also in the very places like Sana'a and Kabul and Mogadishu, where terrorists seek a foothold. Remember that the terrorists we are after target civilians, and the death toll from their acts of terrorism against Muslims dwarfs any estimate of civilian casualties from drone strikes. So doing nothing is not an option.
All right. So there we have it. The president making an argument that fewer people will die with this higher technology than under an old system or if you let the terrorists go. But, Arianna, again, I want to ask you, in terms of public imagination, not only in terms of whether sort of, middle class voters will think, well, this is an OK thing and relax their standards. How is this playing out in poorer neighborhoods where the use of violence is justified in that way? I'll kill fewer than they will.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty suspect argument that Obama is making right there, because frankly, we don't know. He can't possibly claim to know, predict into the future how many people may or may not die from, any number of incidents. But also, I think we've seen that there is a very bad public perception in terms of where violence is used, on whom is it used, on whom is it justified, and which lives are worth saving, which lives are worth protecting, at what cost. We see a really high rates of recruitment in particularly socioeconomically depressed areas in the United States. So I think we need to question who is fighting these wars. There have been a number of high-profile immigrants who were killed. Some of the very first people who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan were immigrants. And so I think we need to question who is fighting these wars, who's making the policies, and who's really suffering the consequences.
And there has been pushback in Latino communities about these recruitment efforts.
Yes, very much so. People very much notice where military recruiters are spending their time, what kinds of offers the military can make to young people. And quite frankly, the military can make a lot of really great overtures in terms of helping out in terms of education, healthcare, and financial stability that we're lacking in a lot of communities.
Well, there's no doubt that the military has provided, you know, a way forward for people who don't have a lot of opportunities. And there's also no doubt that the burdens of war has not been shared between the upper classes and the lower and middle classes of our country. Bob Gates was here, Secretary of Defense, was here at Duke a year or so ago, making that very point that everybody needs to make a bigger contribution in that regard.
Yeah, and I think we've also got to understand that we're no longer in a draft environment. That ended in 1973, so it's basically an all-volunteer force. And I think as we're all agreeing that that's going to attract certain folks and not attract others. So it's a big concern right now for the Secretary of Defense. And how you shape the force to meet the threats of the future is a very, very difficult job, not only for the president, but for the Defense Department.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Scott Silliman is a professor at Duke Law School and an appellate judge at Guantanamo Bay at the United States Court of Military Commission Review. David Chancer, professor at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy and also the director of the Triangle Center of Terrorism and Homeland Security. Ariana Vigil is a professor in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Just ahead, a celebration of spirituals, 100 Men in Black Chorus. Stay tuned.